So, Luigi, how do you interact with the gig economy?
I think I'm pretty boring because I probably use only Uber and Lyft. In preparing this episode, I discovered there is a thing called Fiverr R. I don't know how to pronounce it. Do you know that?
Yeah, I think it's called just Fiverr.
Fiverr, okay.
I don't know if you're supposed to Fiverr.
And you can even subcontract a love letter for $5.
I think the $5 thing is sort of a myth, but I totally believe that you can subcontract love letters. We actually used it a really long time ago when we were thinking about potentially starting a podcast, and we were looking for ideas for logos. I think we had contacted a couple graphic designers at like the very early stage on Fiverr and maybe paid somewhere between like, you know, 50, 100 bucks for just some like preliminary mock-ups.
Okay, so that's not too exploitative.
Well, a little bit perhaps, but yeah, the price was right.
On today's episode, the gig economy. How big is it? Has it been good for workers? And what sort of changes are on the horizon?
From Georgetown University, this is Kate Waldock.
And from the University of Chicago, this is Luigi Zingales.
You're listening to Capitalism, a podcast about what's working in capitalism today.
And most importantly, what isn't. In order to put everybody on the same page, how do you define the gig economy?
This is a tough one because based on the definition, the size of the economy itself can vary anywhere from like 2% of the labor force to 50% of the labor force. A Gallup poll who calls gig economy workers anyone who's working under an alternative work agreement, and that in turn can be split up into people who have multiple jobs or people who have like non-standard jobs, like online platform workers and contractors and on-call workers and like temp workers and stuff like that. And so they estimate, based on a poll, that this is about 36% of the U.S. workforce.
36%?
Yeah.
But that includes a lot of traditional jobs that have been relabeled as gig economy.
Absolutely. And it includes anyone who has multiple jobs, right? So those could just be like multiple regular jobs, or it could be that you have like a full-time salary job, plus you babysit somebody's kids once a week, and that's not really gig economy.
What I think is novel and different of the gig economy is when you have a digital platform that coordinate a large amount of people doing a job. This is the case of Uber, is the case of Lyft, is the case of Airbnb, is the case of Fiverr, is the case of the Mechanical Turks on Amazon. And my understanding is that size of the economy is relatively small, that 5 years ago, Larry Katz and Alan Krueger thought that the gig economy had increased a lot, and increased 5% vis-a-vis the baseline of roughly 10%. And last year, they revised their estimates, and they said the increase was only 1%. By the way, mostly concentrated on the two coasts. So is not a broad phenomenon that is taking over the entire labor force, is a marginal increase, mostly due to Uber and Lyft. And I think we should make a big difference between the people who make some money on the side and people who are permanently employed in the gig economy. There is not big cost overall to have some people working on the side. In fact, this is a benefits provide flexibility. If this becomes the new form of employment, then there are a lot of discussions we need to have, because U.S. regulation in particular is very much dependent on employment. In most countries, your health insurance and your pension does not depend on your employment. In the United States, they do. And so clearly, if the nature of employment is changing, we better change many of this regulation. If the nature of employment is not changing, then that's a different story.
Yeah, and before we change the regulations, we should change the data that we have, right? Like, we should try and get a better sense of how big this gig economy is. I don't think that it actually shrank since 2005. And a point that Katz and Krueger make is that if you look at the administrative tax data, so like a bunch of personal tax records, the number of people who claim to be sole proprietors or working for themselves is going up by a lot. And the number of people who are spending a lot of business expenses and are sole proprietors is relatively constant. So the people who are actually just like running their own private businesses doesn't seem to be explaining that increase. And so there's differing evidence based on whether you're looking at survey data or whether you're looking at tax data. And this whole thing is kind of a mess. Like, we don't have a great sense of how big the actual gig economy is, nor do we have a great definition of it. What do you think about the contract worker, Luigi? So forget about Uber and Lyft for now, but think about someone who, or let's say a janitor for a large company who used to be an employee of that company and used to receive healthcare benefits and retirement benefits from that company. And now they were reassigned to a contract company that then contracts that person out to the original firm that they worked for. Do they count as gig economy workers?
Again, it depends on what you are concerned about. I would say that the janitor who are contracted out is just outsourcing. It's not necessarily a gig economy. To me, what makes it unique and special of the gig economy is that there is a centralized allocation of labor done by a digital platform. That is what is unique because, as you said, the outsourcing of janitors or the outsourcing of some services is not something that started recently. It started in the 90s. While it does pose some of the same problems of the gig economy, I think does not pose some of the other problems of the gig economy. One thing that they have in common that I think we should bring up front because it's very important is the definition of who belongs to the firm, who is an employee to the firm, is quite important in terms of sharing the rents that are produced inside the firm. So a former student of mine wrote a very interesting paper about conglomerates showing that depending on which kind of workers were working with you in the conglomerate, your own salary will change. So if you were a, let's say, construction worker working in a conglomerate with some finance people, that's very hard to imagine, but then your salary was higher than if you are a construction worker working with other construction workers or with some other jobs that are not particularly well paid. And I think that that's an important consideration because we know that even secretarial assistants at Goldman Sachs get paid much better than the typical secretarial assistant. So this tends to increase income inequality.
Let me ask you another question. So this is like a true story. So I'm trying to plan a wedding and I want to hire a DJ. And I was looking around on different platforms and there's an option to go with like an online DJ service company where there's multiple DJs working for this company and then you can hire one of them, but it's coordinated through a platform. And then I found another DJ of seemingly similar quality on Craigslist. So are both of those DJs gig economy workers or is it only the one on the platform?
That's a very good question. This jockey that has the ad on Craigslist is no different than the jockey I used to hire in my old days from a classified ad in the newspaper. On the other hand, when you have a disc jockey that is somewhat operated by a digital platform, is doing more than just matching, in my view, demand and supply, is actually managing the process. And that is the distinctive feature of Uber Lyft. And in my view, is that is the distinctive feature of the gig economy.
I think it's cute that you call it a disc jockey. I haven't heard that one for a while. Yeah, this typology, right? How do you define the gig economy? Everyone has their own definition. And I like a definition that's been proposed by several economists, Abram Haltewanger, Sandusky, and Splitzer, who first distinguished between people that are employees of other companies, which include like temporary agency workers, right? They are still employees of the temp agency versus people that are really classified as self-employed. And they only put the gig economy workers within the self-employed category. And the ones that they count as gig economy workers are like independent contractors or freelancers, day laborers, and then platform workers. And I like that definition, but I think that, Luigi, it seems like in your personal definition, you're only really counting platform workers as gig economy workers.
Yeah, because this is the stuff that is really new and in some sense is substituting stuff that used to be done mostly through firms, through a marketplace. And that's the part that I find more interesting and challenging. What are the effects of this substitution?
I'm going to go with the Abram et al. Definition, which is that and for me, the gig economy is, it includes self-employed people who are independent contractors or freelancers, day laborers, and platform workers.
We can go with your definition, but you realize that a big chunk of that definition includes contract works that have always been contract works. So if I hire a contractor to fix my house, I used to hire them 20 years ago, I hire today. Basically, very little has changed. Maybe the only thing has changed that I check Angie's List for the reputation of the contractor. And before, I made a couple of phone calls to my friends to get references. So that's the major difference. But I don't see that as necessarily problematic or game-changing.
Well, this goes back to this issue of, is the gig economy a myth, right? After Katzenkrueger revised down their estimates of how much the gig economy has changed in the past 10 years, or at least the decade between 2005 and 2015, a lot of people started claiming that the gig economy isn't actually real, that not that many people work in gig economy jobs. And so this goes back to the measurement issue. I think the key takeaway is that the gig economy, as you're describing it, is growing, but it's not like a third of all workers, right? It's not a quarter of all workers. It's maybe, you know, there was a baseline of like several percent, maybe like 10%, according to the current population survey, of people working gig-type jobs even before 2005, even before platforms existed. And it seems like that number has grown a little bit, but not by a crazy amount.
But again, it depends on what we consider the essence, because I can claim that the prospect is the Uberization of works is spreading around the world. Think about what Amazon is doing. If I am a small firm supplying a product to Amazon, I ended up being not very different from a gig worker, because if I end up selling most of all of my supply to Amazon, they dictate all the terms. They end up financing my enterprise, buying all the products, telling me the time of shipping, telling me the characteristics, determining the marketing. So what is the difference between an independent firm and a supplier of Amazon? Is getting more and more nuanced to say maybe it doesn't even exist.
You're right that it's nuanced for sure, but now I feel like you're blurring the lines between the issues of the gig economy and the problems with outsourcing. And they're both issues in both arenas, but I think the problems of outsourcing are like a different set of issues.
No, what I see as central and at the same time problematic of the gig economy is the centralization of the allocation, which is giving market power, especially if this is not an independent platform.
Yeah,
so the difference between, coming back to your example, the difference between the DJ, I cannot call it this jockey, otherwise you think I'm too ancient. The difference between the DJ in Craigslist and the DJ in the platform is that Craigslist does not take a cut in the profit of the DJ, does not tell the DJ what to do or not to do. The DJ is an independent worker announcing or advertising in Craigslist. The DJ working for a platform is like the supply firms work for Amazon, where Amazon, the platform, ends up having an enormous amount of power.
I just think that the problems you're posing are incredibly hypothetical. You're sounding like an economist, right? The problem is that like you're operating in a global marketplace, whereas the reality is that most people using these digital platforms are using them locally. They're drivers or they're movers or, you know, they're delivery people, they're DJs, right? They're providing physical services. And you're right, like there are some people who are doing freelance graphic design on centralized platforms, and that's something that anyone can do around the world. But I think that the vast majority of these gig economy workers are not competing with other gig economy workers in China and India. At least I don't think that that's where their first order problems are. So let's start talking about some of the pros and cons of the gig economy then. The main cons seem to be concerns that gig economy workers are not receiving benefits that they ought to be receiving, and in particular, like healthcare benefits, but also to some extent, like unemployment insurance, as well as a lack of incentive to really save for retirement. But there also seem to be a lot of pros associated with the gig economy, in particular, flexibility and the ability to determine or offset low periods of wages, right? You can like fill in a downturn by working on Uber a little bit, making up that extra money.
I actually would like to distinguish between intrinsic cost of the gig economy and costs that are due to the misdirected way in which regulation is done in the United States. In a sense, the fact that you don't get health insurance if you are gig workers, but you do if you're not, has nothing to do to the new technology, has to do with the silly way in which healthcare is allocated in the United States. If you have a system of universal healthcare, for example, this problem would not exist. On the other hand, some of the problem of the gig economy exists even in countries where you have universal healthcare and you have some form of retirement that's not depend necessarily on your workforce. So while the issue of retirement and healthcare are incredibly important, I think that that could be more easily fixed with a decree of saying you need to provide this or and in some sense, my understanding is Uber and Lyft are going in this direction of trying to provide some of these benefits anyway. So I don't think that that is the more novel and more challenging aspect. The more novel and more challenging aspects, in my view, is number one, as a result of, again, regulation, you don't do any training for this so-called 1099 workers. So if I hire you in my firm, I have an incentive to train you to become better. And that gives you some sort of upward mobility. On the other hand, if I hire you on a platform as a contractor, not only I don't have the incentives to train you because you can leave tomorrow, I cannot legally train you because if I train you, I basically admit that you are an employee and I get all the consequences of being an employee. As a result, all these jobs are very good as temporary flexibility gig, but they're terrible if they are your lifetime employment because there is no chance of progression in life. So if you start being a Uber driver at age 20, you're probably going to still be a Uber driver at age 50. That's from, if you want, an efficiency point of view, from a opportunities point of view. I think that companies have been very important in upward mobilities. There were, in the past, some employees that started as bank tellers and ended up at the top of a bank. My wife's aunt, she grew up in Alabama. She escaped Alabama as fast as she got her high school degree. She went to Indiana. She started working as a bank teller in Indiana. And she ended up retiring as vice president of the bank and head of human resources and was the first woman at the bank to be in that position. So that is a phenomenal opportunity of upward mobility. If you hire everybody on a temporary basis, you don't have the incentives to train and this upward mobility will disappear. So might be efficient to do that from the firm point of view, but then as a society, we need to think about other instruments to provide that kind of upward mobility.
But now I think this is where the definition of the gig economy becomes important again, because it's like, what sort of jobs are being gigified? If you really think that this is digital platform type work, then mostly we would think of Uber and Lyft, and to some extent, like TaskRabbit and Fiverr. And it's hard for me to imagine that those are jobs in which people would have received much training otherwise, right? Like the counterfactual really is that you would have been a cab driver with a medallion, or you would have been, let's say, like someone on Craigslist who was offering services to help people move. And now you just have a more efficient platform for that. And so it's not clear to me that it's really drawing people away from jobs that they would have gotten training in. In fact, I think that the flexibility argument actually means that, especially for drivers, right, compared to people with cabs, they're sort of locked into the cab because there's this upfront cost of the medallion in some cities. Whereas the flexibility of Lyft and Uber, you know, you can do it for a couple months and then stop doing it. I think actually that would give you more incentive to transition into another job where you could then receive training and the upward mobility.
I think that when it comes to cab drivers, you're right. But this is getting spread also for other jobs. The 5R that now I'm finding out we hire for an attempt to do a logo. It was a job that otherwise would be a design firm. And in the design firm, you get trained. If you work on the spot like this, you don't get trained. So that's a typical job where creating a competition might reduce the incentives to train.
So we discussed your views on healthcare, and I share those views, right? That if we just had a functioning healthcare system like most other countries, then this would be a moot point. But what about the incentives to save? Do you think that we should be stepping in and trying to figure out ways to get gig economy workers to save more for retirement? Because the evidence seems to be that they are saving less.
To the extent we believe that people are under-saving for retirement, and I think there is plenty of evidence in this direction, absolutely yes. In a sense, why are we requiring basically people to save for retirement with a certain minimum in regular jobs? Is because we don't trust individuals to be so far-sighted. And we know that if they're not so far-sighted, eventually they ended up in the public dole. So we all have to pay the consequences. And so we introduce regulation, which is to force a minimum amount of savings in order to prevent a massive redistribution exposed. If that rationale is valid, and I think it is, I don't think that should be different for gig economy and non-gig economy. In a sense, one of the things that we have to be more careful, every form of government intervention, is not to create artificial differences between functionally equivalent form of organization, because otherwise people will try to arbitrage among them. Making a big difference between being formally employed and not formally employed generates strong incentives to try to go around that in every possible form or shape. And technology has made incredibly easier to do that. And so now we see more arbiters than in the past. I think even in the past, people were trying, but now they are succeeding in large numbers, and that becomes more of a public policy problem.
So what would this look like in reality? I mean, I'm picturing that, let's say, an Uber driver, for every hour that they drive, they typically make, let's say, like $20. A state might impose regulations that dictate that Uber has to set aside a certain number of those dollars for their retirement, let's say two of those dollars, and that if the employees contribute one willingly, then Uber will contribute another, you know. And so functionally, it might look like they end up only making $16 an hour. Is this the sort of regulation you envision?
Yeah. If I'm an employee of a car driving company, I probably have some form of additional retirement contribution. And in part, I've made by me, in part, matching funds by the company. And I don't know why this should be different if I drive by myself.
Yeah, I'm curious about how that would affect incentives to drive on Uber. I'm not sure that this has been studied very well. Let's talk about some of the good sides of the gig economy. Luigi, what do you think the possible pluses are?
Oh, I think there are many on two sides. Let's start from the worker side. For the worker side is I can have a lot of flexibilities, both in terms of hours and in terms of getting in and out of the labor force. I think that that flexibility is very valuable, especially in a world where you have dual career families. So both the parents work, and in a world where you have aging parents at the same time in which you have kids. And so the obligation of taking care of all these people become quite overwhelming. And I think having some flexibility in this dimension is incredibly valuable. The second part that is more on the in and out aspect is this can provide some insurance. A recent paper by a colleague of mine shows that once you have car hailing services entering into a city, you seem to have an increase in registration of firms and entrepreneurship. The interpretation is that when you have the opportunity to make some money in case things go poorly, is a form of insurance. So you have more the courage to take on the risk of becoming an entrepreneur because you have a buffer in that dimension. And then, of course, from the consumer point of view, I am a big user of both Uber and Lyft. They are very cheap and very convenient. So I think that the combination of the two is pretty remarkable. Now, I fully appreciate that I get subsidized by Wall Street because many of the a significant fraction of the cost of Uber is paid by investors who are hoping to become monopolists in the future and make up with a vengeance on the money they are wasting now. But I think that...
Well, now that they're public, we're the investors, right?
Yeah, indirectly through a pension fund, yes, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And this isn't just speculation, right? Particularly on the flexibility. There's a paper by Hall and Kruger, who was an author on the earlier study we were citing about the size of a gig economy. And in this paper, they poll Uber drivers and ask them, what do you like about driving Uber? By far, the most common response is that it's exactly that flexibility. It allows them to work whenever they want and however long they want. Another interesting finding of that paper is that most of Uber's drivers had full or part-time employment before they joined Uber, and most of those people who had full or part-time employment kept that employment in some form after they started working for Uber. So they continued on in those positions. I think that this is good news. I think it's great that workers have the option to supplement their salaries flexibly, and it doesn't seem like the overwhelming evidence is that it's crowding out their other jobs. Also, to your point about the safety net provided by Uber, there's another cool paper, this one by Fos, Hamdi, Kalda, and Nickerson, that looks at people who use driving Uber as a safety net after a job loss. And what they find is that people who have access to the ability to drive for Uber, they actually use less unemployment insurance. So they rely less on unemployment insurance. They take on less debt, and then they end up with fewer delinquencies. So from like the personal consumer credit perspective, it also seems to have benefits.
And of course, all these studies have been sponsored by Uber.
No, I actually talked to one of the authors of that paper, and he said that they originally weren't maybe going to share some Uber-specific data with them, right? Note that they're not using like Uber-level data. They're just using credit bureau data and then the staggered introduction of Uber. But they ended up not getting it, and they were really upset about it. And they were like, oh, we have good things to say about Uber. They should be willing to work with us. But Uber was not cooperative.
But all the other studies you mentioned about the flexibility, et cetera, where done either by Uber employees or by Uber consultants or by people who had access to Uber data.
I don't think Colin Kruger were Uber employees, were they?
Yeah, Jordan Hall is the chief economist of Uber.
Oh, he is?
And Alan Kruger was a consultant for Uber.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay, well.
Yeah, but this is exactly, but I'm sorry, this is exactly the problem that I'm worried about. The reason why we have overwhelming evidence of the benefits and very scarce evidence of the cost is that Uber and Lyft, but particularly Uber, has massively financed all this research proving the benefits. We economists are already in love with Uber because it's a market, it's technological, it's cool, and because we have a lot of data. And in addition to that, Uber finances economists and give them data to basically push the line how great this is. And there is very little financing and very little data availability to prove the opposite of this. The very same colleague that wrote about the benefit for entrepreneurship wrote about the increase in the number of fatal accidents that take place every time a car sharing service enters a town. And he could not get the data from Uber for his life to try to check it. Why? Because this is something Uber does not want to talk about. So there is a sample selection in the evidence of what we have in economics. And the sample selection is controlled by the very company who have an agenda to push this. That's the reason why I'm so skeptical and so contrarian, because I'm worried that we don't have the full evidence.
I think that that's a really good point. I don't like to speak ill of those who have passed on, but I didn't realize that Alan Kruger was consulting for Uber. He's one of the people who's done a lot of the work in this area, and I'm a little bit, I don't know, I would go back and look at those papers with a slightly different view now that I know that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to know how many people either receive data from Uber or they would like to receive data from Uber. And so clearly, if you speak evil of Uber, you're not going to get the data. So there are not only the people who got the data or got consulting gigs, it's also the people who self-censor themselves because they want to have some data in the future. And not only the data of Uber, this is if I speak evil of Uber, I'm not going to get the data of Uber. I'm not going to get the data from Lyft. Probably I'm not going to get the data from any of these platforms because they don't want to associate with me criticizing the company. And I think this is changing the discussion in economics. I'm very worried about this.
I agree.
At least something we do agree.
We agree on a lot.
No, in this episode, we disagree on even the definition of the gig economy. We disagree
That's
a lot.
True.
And ironically, you seem to be much more in favor than I am about the gig economy. Generally, it's the other way around. Younger people tend to be very frustrated with the gig economy, and older people like me who take advantage of the gig economy, because I have to admit, I take full advantage of it, they tend to be much more in favor. So I think we inverted our roles. Most economics is dedicated to the work of markets. There is a small part of economics dedicated to what is called theory of the firm, where the issue of employment and etc. come about. As economists, we tend to be biased in favor of markets all over the place, and we tend to ignore the issues that are associated with power within firms. The most extreme form is a famous paper by Arshan and Demsad that say that firms don't have any power whatsoever except the normal contracting in the marketplace. So much so that I have a colleague that say, oh, I fire United Airlines because I now take only American Airlines flights. And I said, oh, did United notice? Because if I fire my employee, the employee will definitely notice. So I would like to know whether United is actually crying. So I think it's very important to understand that there is a very important aspect of allocation of power within traditional firms. And then the new platforms are basically minimizing the rents of all the employees by putting them in constant competition. And that can have two types of problems. The first one is, as I said, fewer incentives to specialize and invest to improve the quality of your work within that particular organization. And the second is clearly a reduction on the rent appropriated by the less sophisticated part of the population, increasing the problem of income inequality. So at a time where we're very worried about income inequality, I think that that is something we should definitely be concerned about.
Right, but this again goes back to the issue of how do you define the gig economy? And we had said earlier that contract workers are not part of what we're including in the gig economy in either of our definitions. And I think that contract workers are the ones who are most directly susceptible to the problems that you just described. And the ability of a firm to carve out a certain subset of their employees for tasks that can kind of be like designated to a global marketplace. Like that is the problem with contract working. That and on top, they can, you know, deprive those employees of benefits. I think that the contract work economy is hugely problematic. And that maybe deserves its own separate episode. But it's worth noting that that's distinct from what most people describe as the gig economy.
But I actually disagree. I think that the contract work economy in its traditional fashion is not problematic. Why? Because there is nobody monopolizing the marketplace. The marketplace is simply available to everybody. You can put your name in Craigslist, and Craigslist has no stake, has no taking any cut, and so on and so forth. Very different in a world in which imagine that a platform aggregates all the contractors on one side. Imagine that you have a platform where all the plumbers are. And so if you want to have a plumber, the only way to get a plumber is to get to the plumbing platform. And so you find it very difficult to hire a plumber outside. So you end up paying a lot for plumber. However, that money does not go straight to the plumber. It goes mostly to the platform because they are in a monopoly situation. With platforms, we are going toward a world in which the marketplace is owned by somebody. The marketplace itself should be, in a sense, the ultimate public good where everybody can go, everybody can access in the usual place. Then you have the benefits of the market economy. If you have a intermediary that monopolizes both sides of the market thanks to the network externalities and extract most of the rent, you have a monopolistic economy, which is very problematic.
Yeah, I don't like monopolies either. I just think that we're talking about different issues. There's no reason to believe that these platforms necessarily need to be monopolies. You know, I mean, you can argue that Uber and Lyft are a duopoly, but if anything, they're like competing to the death, and it's benefiting consumers because they're underpricing. They're constantly trying to underprice one another. And then in terms of like a lot of the little other tasks that are in the gig economy, I seem to see competition all over the place, right? Like just looking for DJs, there's multiple gig economy DJ platforms. And I don't see any reason why that would change. And so, yes, this is a concern, but I don't think it's a first order concern.
I think that you're right that now in this moment is not that bad, but I'm worried about the future. You're right that Uber and Lyft are a duopoly. We also learn very clearly in our episode with Isaac that is a duopoly by accident, in the sense Uber was on the verge of crashing Lyft. And if it wasn't for the boycott campaign at the beginning of 2017, we would be now only with Uber. And they are fighting, trying to determine who's going to win. And then only one will survive, and we're going to go to a monopoly. And that's the reason why Wall Street is financing aggressively, is because they count on a monopoly being there down the road. And I think that it's true. At the moment, for the DJs, we have plenty, etc. But we're going to a world in which most of the activity will take place on Amazon, and they will become the marketplace. And I see that, again, as problematic.
Sure. When it comes to regulating monopolies, we need tougher antitrust. I don't think that you're ever going to find any disagreement from me on that one.
Okay, Kate. Is the gig economy capital is or capital isn't?
I think that the biggest capital isn't associated with the gig economy is that we don't know enough about the gig economy, right? Like, it doesn't seem like the current population survey is really measuring the gig economy well. And as you noted, a lot of what we do seem to know about the gig economy seems to be biased by the availability of data and the influence of people who are working for gig economy platforms. And we can't even define it properly. Like, regulators can't even define it properly. And so this just seems to me like the first hurdle that we need to pass is just to know more and have better data about what the gig economy really is. But to the extent that, you know, we believe the gig economy is the use of online platforms that allow people more flexible work schedules and allow them to sort of like buffer negative income shocks, I think that actually there are more merits to the gig economy than we think. But I think that the contract economy is a huge problem, and that's what we should really be worried about, even though it doesn't seem like it's a huge fraction of the U.S. labor force right now. What do you think, Luigi?
First of all, you talk like a true economist. We need more data. We need more work.
It's true.
It's true. But I actually think it's both. On the one hand, there are some aspects that are capitalism at its best, in a sense of providing new services in a very efficient way and providing flexibility to people. I think that is capitalism at its best. On the other hand, there are some important clouds we need to be aware of. And one cloud is the risk of future monopolies and the consequences this might have. And the other cloud is the fact that there is a lot of arbitrage of regulation that takes place in this process. And I think that we need to make sure that this gig economy is not just a gigantic shadow economy, but is a thriving new way to exploit new technology.
You've been listening to Capital Isn't, hosted by Kate Waldock and Luigi Zingales, and produced by Matt Hodapp. Capital Isn't is a podcast of the University of Chicago Stiegler Center in collaboration with the Chicago Booth Review. You can find episode transcripts and research links at capitalism.com. Also, check out promarket.org, the blog of the Stiegler Center, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.